This is KDLG's Bristol Bay and Beyond for Friday, the 1st of May. I'm your host, Dave Benninger in Dillingham. Thanks for joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, an update on the herring fishery and a discussion on chlamydia, which is on the rise in southwest Alaska.
I think the thing that makes it dangerous is the fact that you don't know you have it. And when you are untreated and you don't know, it can lead to sterility.
A Bethel City councilman says he's received a death threat for speaking out about a dangerous drug issue in his community.
You better back off the heroin issue before you kill yourself.
We'll see how some state and federal officials are trying to protect aircraft from all of these migratory birds, and we'll find out exactly who Wade Hampton was and why there's a census area in western Alaska named after him. Plus, we'll stop by behind the scenes of this year's musical Willy Wonka.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination.
Those stories are coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. Last Friday, a jury of 12 in Anchorage found 26-year-old Jerry Active from Togiak guilty in a double homicide and sexual assault case dating to 2013. The state proved that Active had been the one who broke into an Anchorage apartment in May 2013. A child and an elderly woman were sexually assaulted, and the elderly couple was stomped to death. Active is facing up to 99 years in prison. State troopers in Dillingham flew the Nooshogak River last Sunday night looking for an elderly Dillingham couple who were overdue on a skiff ride up to Noostuyahok. Wassily and Lena Kapotic, both in their 80s, had gotten stuck on a sandbar south of Portage Creek, but were in good shape and left that sandbar on the next tide. BBRSDA members elected two new members to their board. Abe Williams and Buck Gibbons beat out their challengers. BBRSDA is still looking for a new executive director and a replacement for the board seat previously held by Robert Hyeno. In the Bristol Bay Borough's special election this week, voters chose to support a $14 million bond package to finance improvement projects to the borough school and approved raising a property tax exemption from $20,000 to $50,000. State and federal officials continue to warn that southwest Alaska is in a period of high fire danger. Tom Dean is acting fire manager in McGrath and has been flying the region regularly.
As far as you could see, there's no snow. And it's very brown. It looks very dry. I've fought fires in Nevada where you fly from the air and you look down and it looks very brown like that. That's exactly what it looks like.
Before green up is the period where most of the wildland fires are caused by humans. Dean says the vegetation is dangerously susceptible to burning right now.
It's a flashy fuel and it's very susceptible to the wind. And it will get away from people very quickly and start what we would call a wildland brush fire or a tundra fire.
In other news, Copper River Seafoods is expanding their presence in the Bristol Bay fishery, confirming this month the purchase of the Naknek plant previously owned by Extreme Seafoods. Marketing Officer Cassandra Squibb says this will build on the company's capacity alongside the Togiak plant.
Our plan this year in 2015 is for the Naknek operations to produce a mix of fresh and frozen H&G sockeye salmon, and that will increase our total production of Bristol Bay sockeye by roughly 4 to 5 million pounds.
She says they're still taking on fishermen for this next season and will have a total of 8 tenders, 5 in Naknek Kwejak and 3 in Togiak. And yesterday, the Alaska House and Senate each passed a resolution to recess until May 12th, calling it a cooling-off period. Governor Bill Walker has been critical of the legislature, calling on them to finish work, passing a balanced budget before taking a vacation. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. Alaska's largest herring fishery opened Monday night at 8 p.m. and the first catches in Togiak were delivered and reported by Wednesday morning. Managing this fishery is biologist Tim Sands at the Dillingham Fish and Game Office, and I spoke with him a little bit ago for a quick update. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Dave.
What do we know as of Friday morning here?
Right now, we're still missing one company report, but we have a total harvest for yesterday of 2,162 tons. And a combined total harvest for the purseine fishery of 4,057 tons.
And we don't know the gillnet fishery because there's only two buyers.
That's right. That's confidential. We can't release that.
So we're not exactly sure how close we're getting to the total harvest yet, but somewhere more than a tenth of the way there.
Sure.
Okay. How's the fishery going so far in your mind?
So far, so good. I talked to a couple people out there on the grounds, and they're pleased so far. They're finding good fish. The fish are still big. They're getting a good roe percent, so people seem to be happy.
And when we spoke with Matt Jones yesterday, he said that on Wednesday's flight, I believe, there was just a great deal of spawn and a lot of herring in the district.
Yeah, we saw a lot of herring. We saw a lot of spawn. We didn't fly an official survey yesterday, but we did go out there to do other stuff, and we did see a lot more spawn yesterday.
Tim, do you plan on leaving the fleet to kind of fish pretty wide open as long as their buyers want the herring?
Yes, and until they quit buying or we get to the quota.
And do you have any idea how long that you think this fishery will be open at this point, maybe another 10 days or so?
You know, usually things wind down after 10 days of fishing, so we're in day three now, so I would guess that somewhere around day 10 to day 12, we'll either take the quota or people will just be satisfied.
Well, they certainly don't have anything to complain about weather-wise. It's just been pretty nice out there, it seems.
I know one day there was a lot of fog. Right before it started, it was pretty windy when they were trying to do stuff, transfer fuel and whatnot. But, it could be a lot worse.
Tim Sands, thanks for the Friday update. And if we don't speak sooner, talk to you Monday morning, I hope.
All right. Talk to you later.
Well, herring, it seems, is not all that folks in Southwest Alaska are catching. The Department of Health and Social Services released numbers this week that show that Southwest Alaska saw a 13% jump in the number of reported cases of the STD chlamydia. Per capita, only the interior region had a higher overall number of cases. It's not a good trend. To talk more about this, we have Dillingham Public Health Nurse Gina Carpenter with us. Gina, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Dave.
What is chlamydia exactly?
Well, chlamydia is a sexually transmitted infection. We call them STIs, and it's a bacteria.
What are symptoms, and do people know when they have it if they come to see you?
Symptoms can be discharge or burning with urination or pain, but generally people don't have symptoms, which is part of the reason that we see the incidence of the disease that we do.
Is it a dangerous infection as far as STDs go?
I think the thing that makes it dangerous is the fact that you don't know you have it. And when you are untreated and you don't know, it can lead to sterility. It can also lead to other systemic infections over time, which can make you quite sick and hospitalized.
If a person is diagnosed with chlamydia, is there a treatment?
Yes, there's an easy treatment. They can come to the public health center and be treated confidentially. It's just an oral medication that they take one time.
Before we get to how to avoid it, let me ask why you think our rates in Southwest Alaska may be so high.
I know. We just get the bad rap, don't we? I think we have really good screening out here. I think that people are conscientious overall, and they do want to be tested, and they know that they can get safely and confidentially treated. What I think our real problem is substances, and the use and abuse of substances puts people at risk to choose risky behaviors that they wouldn't otherwise.
According to public health information, our one-year rate has gone up 13%, but really the five-year rate is a 0% change, meaning over a five-year average, no more cases than we saw back in 2010 now as an average, but also no less. We're not going down. What do we do?
Thanks. That's a great question. What do we do? It's a concerted effort, but everybody needs to recognize that those choices are their own, and there are ways that you can protect yourself, and safe sex is the first one.
I suppose everybody knows, but what are some methods to making sure that your sexual activity is safe?
Well, I think condoms. A lot of people don't, you know, like to use condoms, but condoms are a barrier. They protect you from infections like chlamydia and also can protect you from things that are worse, like HIV. If you do get into a relationship that becomes sexual, having both yourself and your partner tested before you become intimate would be a great start.
If our infection rates are so prevalent, why is condom use not more prevalent itself?
Right. I think there's a trust issue there. I think that some people in relationships feel that there's a lack of trust if a condom is required. And that's really not the case. The case is everyone should be using condoms until they are mutually exclusive, which means they have sex with nobody else but just each other.
Now, that's one set of choices, but you're working on some other ones, too, some other factors that come into play.
In my experience, substance abuse is a risk factor into itself. When you're under the influence, it puts you in a mood to make choices that you might not make if you were sober. And I think that with our high use of substances and the increase that we're seeing in heroin, which is unfortunately becoming more visible, we just put ourselves at great risk. And it takes community effort. And that's why I so appreciate you letting us come and talk to people over the radio about this. There are ways to help protect our community and each other.
Can you preview for us the screening and brief intervention that you're working on now and then come back and talk to us later?
I would love to. You know, public health nursing just was recognized nationally by CDC for a new program that we're implementing at the health center, and it's primarily acknowledging that people drink and use alcohol, but how can you drink and use alcohol safely and wisely?
All right. Gina Carpenter is a nurse at Public Health here in Dillingham. Gina, thanks so much.
Thank you, Dave.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. We're going to look now to Bethel, where citizens, similar to many Bristol Bay communities, are struggling to find solutions to combat the growing use of heroin and opioids. Newly elected Bethel City Councilman Byron Machinsky has been outspoken on the issue, and on account of that, says he received a threatening note telling him to drop it. He joins me now. Byron, thanks for speaking with me. In the article that was written about this incident, it referenced that you have taken on heroin use as an important issue for you on the council. Can you tell me why and also what you're doing about it?
Well, just because how destructive the drug is, and everyone could see the effects. A lot of people know somebody that's addicted to it, and most of these people are my age, my old classmates and everything.
How old are you? How old are you, Byron?
I'm 28.
Okay. So it's you think becoming more widespread in Bethel?
It is becoming more widespread, not only in Bethel, but the whole Delta area. Seems though as a lot of people are moving in here because they could make a bigger profit in this area than they could in Anchorage or downstates.
Tell me what you're trying to do about it there in Bethel on the council.
What we've been doing so far is just trying to raise awareness. I've been talking to a lot of people that dealt with heroin, whether it's in their family or however that may be, to come speak up as much as they can. This last council meeting, we had a proclamation identifying heroin as a major problem in the town, and we made this week from the 27th, I think, to the 2nd, Heroin Awareness Week. And May 12th, we're having another meeting, and we're going to have a action memorandum directing administration to set up tip lines and other ways the public could contact the authorities or us if they want to give tips on known dealers or suppliers.
I imagine you're getting some support, probably pretty widespread support from some parts of the community.
Yeah, there's been calls or emails saying similar things that are going on in their town all over Alaska. And Dillingham also, I've been talking to a few people there, and they just want to be a part of it and help organize meetings. And
but you got some very scary pushback. What happened here?
Well, on Friday, somebody came to my house around 10:30, came up the steps. I didn't see them. My girlfriend thought she seen somebody, so she went to the window and looked, and that's when they ran off, and I went outside looking for them. And we didn't think that much of it. We thought it might have been a drunk or something at the door. Until I went to work the next morning is when I found a note in my Jeep saying, you better back off the heroin issue before you kill yourself. And if you call the cops, we'll know about it. And the next time I see you walking around your shop, you won't make it back in.
That's a pretty sobering or scary note. How did you react?
Well, obviously kind of worried. Not so much scared, but a little worried about not really myself, but my family and everything. And I was, after that, I just got very infuriated. And we went to the troopers right after with my dad and went to the mayor and talked with him. And the mayor brought us to the Bethel Police Department, and we had a meeting over there and just trying to figure out who it could possibly be and what to do about it from here.
Will this cause you to slow down or back off this issue now that you've raised it, helped to raise it?
No. It makes me even want to push harder.
Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
That was Byron Machinsky, a member of the Bethel City Council, who says he received a death threat last week on account of his outspokenness on the issue of heroin in town. This is Bristol Band Beyond on KDLG. We'll be back in a moment. If you haven't noticed, migratory birds are making their way up north, and many are looking for a nice pond or lake to rest their wing, but they won't find a warm welcome at Dillingham's airport. Birds, as you may know, can disrupt air travel and compromise air safety. KDLG's Matt Martin reports that state and federal officials are working to keep these uninvited guests away.
As the sun rises over Wood River, Jonah Rothletter stands near the boat launch next to Icicle Seafoods. He counts birds, but birding is more than just a hobby for Rothletter. It's his job. Rothletter is a wildlife specialist for the USDA. He's working on a year-long study to determine and minimize the risk that birds pose to the airport in Dillingham. He's out by Icicle because it's a common flight path for airplanes.
And this is actually a flight path that a few planes will take. They'll fly over the Wood River upon takeoff, or they'll come in this way for landing. So right now we're seeing some glaucus gulls flying and some mew gulls.
Binoculars hang around his neck as he tallies the birds he sees. Rothletter says they need to know how many birds are around and where they travel so they can plan best how to keep them out of the frequent flight paths.
Essentially, airplanes have giant vacuum cleaners attached to them to pull them through the air.
And a goose sucked into the engine or crashed through the windshield can be damaging and dangerous to planes. You may remember what happened to U.S. Airways Flight 1549 in 2009 as it took off from New York City.
Birds flew into both of the aircraft's engines. The pilot quickly realized he could not return to the airport and land. His options were severely limited, and the only place to go down, in fact, was the Hudson River just off Midtown Manhattan.
That's an NBC News clip from what became known as the Miracle on the Hudson, because everyone made it safely off the plane. Rothletter wants to see that something like that doesn't happen at the Dillingham Airport. John Taylor is with the Department of Transportation at the Dillingham Airport. Every morning at 8 a.m., the DOT drives up and down the runway, checking for any damage to the tarmac, broken lights, or wildlife that could pose a danger to planes.
And the seagulls kind of make their rounds, too. They out the dump, and they stop here.
Often, Taylor will carry a shotgun with him on these early morning patrols to scare off any unwanted fowl. As Taylor drives down the center of the tarmac, three sandhill cranes fly overhead and land west of the runway.
Yeah, that's a big bird to hit something.
He stops the car and shoots off a cracker shell, basically a firecracker, to make a loud noise to scare the birds away. The cranes take off and land at a safe distance outside the airport fence.
You're not fixing the problem if you're just making things go boom. You're just putting a Band-Aid on a situation.
Back at Icicle, wildlife specialist Jonah Rothletter says there is nothing wrong with scaring away birds. It's actually necessary, but ideally, you don't even want the birds there in the first place.
All animals are looking for food, water, shelter, just like we do.
If birds can find one of those things at or near the airport, you can bet they're going to stick around that area.
They're coming there for a reason. why not just go right to the source and eliminate that?
Rothletter calls it habitat modification. He says if birds are coming to a marshy area near the airport, just dry it out. No water, no birds. After Rothletter is done with his study, he'll work with the airport to come up with a plan best how to manage the habitat in and around the airport. In Dillingham, I'm Matt Martin.
If we mention the name Wade Hampton, I wonder if this comes to mind.
The highest unemployment rate in the state in August was the 22.8% recorded in the Wade Hampton census area. It was a whopping 26.1% in the Wade Hampton census area, as the 20.5% recorded in the Wade Hampton census area.
Well, that's former KDLG News Director, my former boss, Mike Mason, who always included the Wade Hampton census area in his dutiful rundown of the monthly unemployment numbers. As Mike repeatedly pointed out, Wade Hampton has the highest unemployment rate in the state and is per capita one of the poorest places in the U.S. Sandwiched between the Nome and Bethel census areas, Wade Hampton is an unorganized borough encompassing some 15 communities, including Hooper Bay, St. Mary's, Kotlik, and Emonic. But who exactly is or was Wade Hampton, and why is this area named after him? Lisa Diemer, a reporter for Alaska Dispatch News based in Bethel, knows. She wrote an article about him last week and joins me now from Bethel. Hi, Lisa.
Hello.
So, first of all, who was Wade Hampton?
Well, he was a Confederate general. He was a slave owner. He was also a U.S. senator and governor of the state of South Carolina.
Well, before we go any further, what prompted you to take the time to write an article? Where did this come up on your agenda?
Well, probably like a lot of people, the name had always stood out. And it had been kind of in the back of my mind. I need to someday check who is Wade Hampton, but I had never gotten around to it. Anyone can Google and get a good bit of information pretty quickly today about who he was. But it came to my attention when I was actually asking about a different name out in Hooper Bay, and I was asking Myron Nanning about that. And he responded back about the name I was inquiring about, but then almost as an aside, said, well, you know, Wade Hampton, Confederate general, slave owner. And he said, KKK member. That part turned out to be not exactly right, but actually a little close.
Okay, so Wade Hampton is known for some of these unflattering things, but also a couple of neat ones, too. What stood out to you about some of his more favorable attributes and some of the less favorable ones?
Just a quick note on that. I think kind of in the, you know, in today's world, you know, it's hard to think of him as being, you know, in a favorable way. But for his, you know, because of his history and what he did, but for his time, I mean, these were the type of people who were the leaders of the South. They were slave owners. When he was elected governor, and that's a whole other story, that was sounds like the messiest election in history, but he ended up being seated as governor of South Carolina in 1877 after the disputed 1876 election. But he then went on to do some things. He appointed over 100 black men to office in South Carolina, and he had funding for schools, more per capita for schools, which were segregated then, that had black children than those with white children. And there were a lot more black children in the state of South Carolina, so there was a lot more funding for schools with black children. So those were a couple of the things that historians had mentioned to me that were surprising to them.
But obviously some unflattering things too, which you mentioned earlier. But one thing that's important to point out here is that Mr. Hampton never stepped foot in the territory of Alaska. So what's the connection? Why the census area named after him?
His son-in-law was also, you know, a semi-prominent person named John Randolph Tucker. And his son-in-law came to Alaska in 1913. By then, Wade Hampton had already died. He died in 1902. But Tucker came to be federal judge in Nome. And in those days, federal judges, you know, they were the authority. They were the feds, and they had all the power. Alaska was a territory, and they did a lot of things. And among the things this guy did, Tucker, is he named an old mining district and he split it in two, and he named part of it Wade Hampton. So it started as a mining district, kind of a land recording district, and evolved into the census area.
And you're hearing now from some folks in the region that based on some of the things that have come to light about Mr. Hampton, that they would like to see the name changed. Is that the case, and is that an easy thing to do?
Yeah, it is the case. I guess there's been this quiet discontent that's brewing. People have not made a public cause about it before now, but there have been inquiries made of the legislature and of others, and it seems to be, in fact, a simple process. The Census Bureau told me that if the state submits something from the governor or some other entity from the state saying that they want a new name, the Census Bureau will change the name. So it's not a very involved process. The state demographer told me that, you know, there needs to be consensus in the state for a new name, and I asked him how that would materialize. He said that's still being reviewed. So the process still needs to be worked out to a degree, but it doesn't seem to take a new law. It doesn't require Congress to do something. So, yeah, it doesn't seem that involved.
Well, we'll certainly watch for updates. Lisa Deemer's article in Western Alaska, Push to Rename a District That Honors Slave-Owning Confederate General, is in the Alaska Dispatch News. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Dave.
And before we go this week, I went behind the scenes yesterday as students and adults worked out the kinks of this year's musical performance of Willy Wonka, which goes on stage this weekend. Here's what some of the performers, stagehands, and the rest involved had to say at their first and possibly final dress rehearsal. The first voice is co-director Pat Ingen.
Oh, I think it's going great. We have a really good group of kids this year. They're a pleasure to work with.
Can I go down the line and ask you guys what your name is and what you're doing with the play?
I'm Sawyer Sands, and I'm going to be doing the light changes.
Shannon Spring, I'm the sound effects guy.
My name is Christopher Marks, I'm the technical director.
What's your name?
Logan Ito.
And what's your job with the play?
I'm a spotlighter.
Is it going well?
Yes, it is, and I'm enjoying it.
What's your name?
Darren Napoli.
And what's your role in this ordeal?
Phineas Trout, the reporter.
What do you enjoy about your character?
I enjoy the fact that I get to be a smart aleck to all the kids.
Nervous at all for the weekend?
No, no, I'm actually really excited for it. It should be a good weekend.
What? Bare imagination. Explanation.
Can we start that over? Like, there was a pause and it threw me off. What? I know.
Logan Ball.
So what's happening backstage? What all you got?
We get everybody ready and we have all the props back here. And so every scene change, we need to remove the old props and put on new ones and get everything set up and round up everybody else who will need to be on stage.
Has that been tough to do? Keep everybody rounded up?
Sometimes, because like we don't know where everyone is because they're spread out through the whole school.
Some of these performers look like divas to me. Are you having troubles with them?
No, they're fun.
How's your curtain puller there? Reliable?
Yeah, he's good. This is the first time he's been doing it.
What's your name?
Deshaun Small.
And what's your role?
I'm playing as James, one of the Candymen.
All right, what's your favorite line in it?
Because me, I'm a wonker. Wonker, yeah.
Are you going to be ready for tomorrow night?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Name?
Christian Udlash.
What's that cool hat you're wearing?
I don't even know.
What's your part?
I'm just a Candyman kid. I don't really know if he has a name in specific. I don't really have any talking lines outside of the song.
What's your name?
I'm David Wetter.
All right, David, what's your character?
I'm Augustus Gloop.
You're Augustus. So you have some lines, huh?
Yes.
What's one of your favorite lines?
Probably one of my favorite lines is, here's my golden ticket, Mr. Wonka. Achoo! And I sneeze all over him.
Great. What's your name?
Lacey Andrew.
Are you nervous for tomorrow night?
Kinda, not really.
No? What's your role?
Singing.
All right, and what's your name?
Grace Jackson.
All right, Grace, what's your role?
Singing.
What's your character?
Oh, a chef, a cook.
And you?
Ryan Burkowski.
What's your character?
I'm also a cook.
Is this your first time on stage?
I've been on stage a lot of times.
So you're an old veteran.
Yeah.
Do you get nervous?
A little bit.
Are you going to break a leg?
Not literally.
Who can take a rainbow, wrap it in a sigh, soak it in the sun and make a strawberry lemon pie?
Elijah Hunt.
What's your role in this?
I am Willy Wonka and the Candyman.
You don't seem to get much of a break off stage.
Not really. No, this is probably the longest break I have.
Are you guys going to be ready for the big performance?
I certainly hope so. I'm very confident in everyone else's ability with their lines and their cues. The cues need to be worked on, but I believe that we'll be ready by the time showtime rolls around.
One question for you. Who can make the sun rise?
The Candyman can.
And that's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond, our weekly news magazine on KDLG. Catch us Fridays at noon and 6:30 on AM 670 and at 8:30 on 89.9 FM. Send us your feedback and ideas to news@kdlg.org. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. There's much to do this weekend, and we hope you enjoy it all, and we'll see you back here next week.